This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Ralph Friedman. And you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. Project, welcome back to this episode with John Welborn, who we've had on before. If you haven't heard of John Welborn, he is a 10-year, or yeah, he's a 10-year veteran of the NFL. Played for 10 years straight until an injury put him out, and now he runs a company called Power Athlete. If you don't know about Power Athlete, they basically are taking what originally was mostly CrossFitters, but now a lot of field sport athletes and turning them into beasts in the weight room. So they're improving athletic performance in the weight room, and that's really their thing. That's all their content's about. That's what their programs offer, and that's what their podcast is about as well. So we had an amazing chat with John, as always. You will get a little bit... we get a little bit sidetracked in this podcast, as we expected with John Welborn. He likes to go down certain rabbit holes, and so we just let him go down the hole. We chased him down there, and we didn't really stick to the script as much as we normally do on this podcast, but I feel like we covered a lot of important ground anyway, and yeah, it was an awesome talk.
Yeah, this is the time where people want to, you know, go down the crazy rabbit holes. We are in a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
That is the situation of the world, so now is the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also a great time for you guys to take nutrition seriously. If you want to, if you really struggle to make changes on your own, I will put my hand up and say that is me. You know, it's nice to know what to do, but doing it is a whole beast in itself. So if you guys struggle to make change in your nutrition and you feel like you need someone to hold you accountable, you want to do it in a way that is really easy with an app that just makes a lot of sense. It doesn't have any fluff around it. It ties in nicely with MyFitnessPal. It gets you to check in once a week, record scores, take photos. If you're looking for that level of accountability and obviously great coaching to go along with it, we recommend Working Against Gravity. So if you guys want nutrition coaching, workingagainstgravity.com. We're on their nutrition coaching at the moment, getting coached both by Brad. He's doing a fantastic job with us, keeping us on track with our goals and just kind of mentally keeping us in check with all the different variables that are happening, you know, in our day-to-day lives at the moment. So if you guys go to workingagainstgravity.com, sign up to their nutrition coaching and use the code MMP50. That's MMP50, one word, you'll get 50% off.
And the show is also brought to you by True Protein today. They obviously have an incredibly wide variety of different products you can get, but the one guarantee I will always give everyone that tries it, it is incredibly good tasting, and it never leaves anyone with a poor feeling in their stomach or a bad reaction from it. It's just the cleanest stuff out there.
Yep.
And we have reliably had this test with new people trying it for over 6 years now.
Yeah. And the one staple that's made its way into my regular nutrition now is the Super C, which is their new vitamin product, which is basically a combination of vitamin D, vitamin C, and zinc. And I know it does have some magnesium in there as well. And a couple of other products got collagen protein in there as well. And that's their kind of immune boosting product that they brought out with the whole virus thing that's happened. And it tastes delicious and it's an amazing product. And I would recommend, it's kind of bringing up some of the lacking micronutrients that you might find in a common diet. So checking that out. Super C from True Protein is one of their newest products. It's definitely worth a try. It tastes amazing, of course, as always. But have a look at the vitamins in there. If you feel like you get some issues around your immune system and you want to bring up your vitamin D levels, this is the perfect product for that. So if you guys head to trueprotein.com.au and you use the code MINDMUSCLE10, you will get 10% off any of their products. All right, guys, let's jump into it with John Welborn. Yeah, is there anything you guys... Obviously, we want to hear all the updates about everything that's happened for you guys. We can get into it, but I know you're promoting more of the sports rehab side of things. I know you got the ACL thing going at the moment. Is there anything else you wanted to kind of promote towards the end of the show that we can help out?
Just our programs. I think we do a really good job on you know, kind of hitting all those demographics. The ACL thing is just something that's kind of near and dear to me, just because I tore my ACL when I was pretty young, probably 18 years old, and didn't realize it until I was in my 20s, and then had surgery, and it was it's been one of my greatest regrets that I didn't understand the mechanism of torn ACL, and more importantly, I didn't understand the rehab protocol.
Mm.
So I never wanted another athlete to have to go through that. And unfortunately, when I looked around, I just wasn't – like nothing really knocked my socks off in terms of like how do you train to avoid this? And are coaches being taught how to assess this so that you can see it happen and start understanding the markers and then start fixing it? So that was really the kind of the whole – energy behind the course, was empowering the coaches to stop it because unfortunately a coach isn't going to be able to put that together. You know, a sport coach is just focused on the skill aspect. I mean, so the strength coach, it gets kind of deviated to them, or really the big one is the parent. I've always been a big advocate of parents being as educated as they can. My dad didn't know anything about lifting weights in sports, and my mom didn't either. So like I was like zero direction. I remember I told my dad I wanted to lift weights, and he's like, why do you want to do that? It's what dumb people do. It's just counting over and over again. And I was like, no, Dad, I want to be big and strong. Like, I think it's going to be important. And he was just like, this is ridiculous. And so he wouldn't get me a gym membership. So my mom got me a gym membership, didn't tell him, and then she would drive me to the gym. And yeah, so it's like a really funny story. But like, I went out for the track team and wanted to wanted to run, and like, you know, always wanted to train and lift weights, and it was just something that was really important to me. So I ended up tearing my ACL in like the stupidest way. I was at a buddy's house. He had like an old tree fort, and we were standing in the tree fort, and he like lived off like on like the top of a hill, which had his bitch in view. And so I'm up there, like we're looking at it, and like, oh, this is cool. So I go to climb down, and the ladder was pretty old and rotted out. And one rung above the ground, it broke, and I drove my knee, my leg, straight legged, right into the ground. Felt a pop in my knee, and all of a sudden my knee exploded and like and swole up. And I went home, and I was supposed to go play in an all-star game for football about, you know, a week later. And I told my brother, I didn't even tell my mom. I was like, dude, my knee's fucked. My brother's like, let's get in the pool. So we jumped in the pool, and he just did like manual therapy for like 3 days. And all of a sudden, like the swelling went away. And it was okay. I went to the Shrine game. They put me through a physical. The doctor checked it. And he's like, I don't think you tore your ACL. I think you're fine. Played. It wasn't until my third year of college. I took a helmet to the head and got knocked unconscious in like towards the end of the year. And then the next game, I came back. I was running on a reverse and just randomly slipped in the grass. Tore some cartilage. The knee swole up again. They went in and they scoped the knee and found out I didn't have an ACL. And they repaired it on the spot.
Oh, fuck. So you went 3 years without an ACL. That's pretty incredible.
Without even knowing. And they had checked my knee a dozen times, and they couldn't tell I was missing an ACL.
What? That's nuts.
So, like, the insertion of my hamstring is really, like, overdeveloped.
Right.
So they think that, like, the way my hamstring and the structure for my hamstring had developed in such a way that it guarded. And actually, I don't even have an ACL anymore. I tore the graft somewhere during my NFL career. And it wasn't until I got my knee scoped after I retired, the doctor's like, we fixed, like I had a piece of, like a chipped off piece of bone, and I had like a, so I had a bone chip in my knee. They went in, they cleaned the bone chip, debrided the knee, fixed it all up. And the doctor, when I woke up, was like, your knee looks great. Everything's fine. And, you don't have an ACL. I was like, got a problem? He's like, no, not at all. He's like, I couldn't even tell your ACL was torn until I put you under. So everything was so thick and, overdeveloped. He's like, it just feels stable. Now when I put you under, I can tell you it's torn, but he's like, I would never have known it.
So it sounds like hamstring strength, like really overdeveloped hamstring strength, can compensate for no ACL. That's how it sounds.
Yeah. Yeah. Or if you overdevelop, or if you really develop your hamstrings, you protect your ACL.
Right.
So the thing that we really looked at is there's, you know, a couple different types of athletes. One of the athletes is very ligament dominant, in that they don't have enough strength and musculature and size and really what I call armor, so that when they decelerate, cut and everything, the ligaments become the predominant kind of source for this movement. And what we want our athletes to be is be more muscle dominant, where the muscles are absorbing the force, they're absorbing the change of direction, and they're not stressing the ligaments. The people that are more ligament dominant tend to tear them. The people that are more muscular dominant don't tear ACLs. So we really have to not only develop the musculature, the strength, the stability, all that in the weight room, but then you have to be able to progress and teach these guys good technique and good movement, foot position. When you cut, the foot has to be vertical, especially with the knee over the end step. And there's just like a lot of mechanics that are taught to protect that. And really, because once it tears, they go in and they fix it. There's a ton of like sensory perception and a bunch of nerve endings in that ACL. It's about as big as a pinky. And it's pretty thick, and it gives you a whole bunch of really interesting proprioception that all of a sudden just gets knocked out. And about 1/3 of the population can perform flawlessly without an ACL. About 1/3 of the population, okay, and about another 1/3 of the population can't do anything. So I'm what's known as a compensator, whereas I tore my ACL and I never noticed. So like I can compensate around it. Other people would tear an ACL and couldn't walk down a stair.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, look at what happened in the NBA finals last year when the league was actually open and operating.
Yeah.
You know, Klay Thompson, he went up for a dunk and he got hit in the air, landed funny, tore his ACL, and it was like, oh shit, he was in screaming pain. And then literally within 30 seconds, he was up, running, doing sprints up and down the court, doing shooting. And they were like, look, you've torn, they took him back. He took two shots, made the shots, played it, the ball went out. So they took him around the back. They're like, hey, we just got to test it. You know, he's like, no, I'm fine. Let me play. And they're like, look, you tore your ACL. But before that, he was saying, you know, I feel good. Like, let me play. So yeah, what it tells me is that it's obviously important. That's why we have it, but it's not essential if you can, you know, train and strengthen around it.
Well, it just comes down to like, so Dr. Craig Buehler, who's a guy, if you listen to Power Athlete Radio, he's been on, he spoke at the symposium for us. Dr. Buehler has a deal called AMIT, Activated Muscle Integration Technique, and he's out of Kaysville, Utah. And he developed this whole system based on the idea that as injury happens, muscle starts shutting down. And over time, when enough muscle shut down, that's when people have some pretty gnarly injuries. And he's worked with, I mean, every gold medalist, you know, he's in Utah, so he works with a lot of skiers, a lot of professional athletes. I go see him a couple times a year. He made a good point to me once. He said the world's best athletes aren't necessarily the world's best athletes because they're more gifted than other people. It's because those athletes have gotten to a point where they're able to compensate around their injuries and they can still perform at a high level, where a lot of probably much better athletes get injured and then they no longer can compensate around it. So his deal was, the world's best athletes are just the world's best compensators.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So for me, you know, when I went to him, I think of like the 160 muscles he tested, like 125 were shut down. And he's like, first of all, I can't believe you walked in here. And he's like, I can't even believe that you were playing in the NFL. Like, how did this happen? And I'm like, man, I got to the point where I knew things weren't working. And I just started developing probably bad patterns to compensate around these injuries.
Mm.
And then it wasn't until I worked with him and he kind of rebalanced everything. And I always remember I walked out of there after 3 days, took a step and like jumped up on the hood of the car. It was a rental. And then stepped down and thought, shit, man, I can go back and play in the NFL. And but then I was like, you know what? It's probably time to hang it up and not do it.
Yeah, yeah. There's some pretty interesting stuff coming through at the moment. Now, John, before we go more into that sort of stuff and down some more rabbit holes, let's give us an update on, we haven't spoke for a while, so last time we spoke, we spoke to Chris. He came and visited, but you guys just moved to Austin. You were obviously building what you have now. So it's been a couple of years. So catch us up. What's happened since you moved to Texas? Obviously moved out of LA, and kind of where's the direction of Power Athlete going now? And then, of course, I want to get into kind of the future of sport and sport coaching as well, with everything that's kind of unfolded with the lockdown.
Yeah. Really, the mission of Power Athlete's always been, like, I mean, it's always been the same. I mean, the idea of being able to provide training systems for athletes that I think are some of the best on the planet, being able to work with the best people and be able to develop a system where we can really foster and develop athleticism. You guys, you know, obviously are familiar with CrossFit and understand that market and the idea of like training for fitness. The way I always looked at fitness is it's pretty specific to what I need. Your fitness might be different than your fitness and my fitness and what we need it for. But unfortunately, performance is the measuring stick for everything. Like, can you use your training to perform at the highest level? So while I understand the need for fitness, I don't get romanced by it. At the end of the day, you could be the fittest dude on the planet, but if you don't perform at a high level, you're of no value to me. So when I look at performance, there's a bunch of factors that fit into performance, not only skill acquisition, but skill execution. And then the biggest one is athleticism. So I became kind of obsessed with the idea of increasing athleticism, the idea that all things being equal, the most athletic person on the field or the most athletic position or person between two people is going to be the biggest, win the most battles. Kind of like if all things are equal, the fastest person usually wins. Mm. Same thing with my job, especially playing in the NFL. If I could get into a situation where everything was stacked and things were pretty even, I knew the best athlete would win. And really, my ability to demonstrate and develop and really show athleticism is what I became romanced with. And that's a really interesting thing because it's extremely hard to quantify. There's no metric for it, but it's one of those things that when you see it, you know it. It's like you might not know nothing of cars, but when a front engine V12 Ferrari pulls up and you hear that sound, like everybody stops and looks because it doesn't sound like anything else and it looks sleek and fast. And you're like, I don't know anything about cars, but I know that thing's really pretty. It's aesthetic, right? And yeah. it's like a really pretty girl walks into the room or somebody that's good looking who's different than other people, like instantly it catches your eye and you're like, man, something's different. And that's what athleticism is. You watch people perform and whether it, you know, and you can think of whatever arena, whether it be boxing, basketball, football, or any of the other sports, you know, rugby or whatnot, you watch people do things that are above and beyond what the average person can do, where it like, you know, you lose your breath or a little bit, or you hold it and you think like, I want to watch that in replay, or how did they do that?
Hmm.
And to me, that became really the hallmark, like the gold standard for my athletes, that if I could develop and foster athleticism and give them that, I think they'd be miles ahead. And then we kind of got in this idea, is it just God-given talent? Or some people just naturally get more gifted? And so I took a step back and thought, man, if I can define athleticism, then I can start building the pieces to develop it. And I'll tell you, I would not say I'm the most athletic person, but because I understood athleticism and I understood the position in which I played in football, I would fool you into thinking I was athletic.
Hmm.
And that really came full circle for me about, man, 9 or 10 years ago, about a year after I'd retired from the NFL, I worked as a contractor for Naval Special Warfare. So I went to top performance for the SEAL teams. And I was flying back from the East Coast. The U.S. military is extremely cheap. So they booked me on a coach. I was able to get an exit row in the middle. Thank God. And as I was coming back, I sat next to a fairly young, like probably like about my age, probably late 20s, early 30s. I think I was 33 at the time. And like black dude. And he was sitting there like looking at a tablet and he was going over end zone and sideline, which is, film that's being shot from the end zone and sideline for football games. None of that is commercially available. So the only one that would have it would be like if you were on the team and it's just for internal use.
Yeah.
So this guy's watching cut-ups. And I kind of like glanced over and I saw it and like, you know, instantly I know he's probably not just a spectator or maybe some crazy fantasy football guy that hacked the system, you know? So I'm kind of watching and I'm kind of watching him and he kind of like turns it to me like this and I kind of look and, you know, kind of nod my head. And so he takes off his headphones. He's like, what are you looking at? I'm like, man, the left tackle, shit, he's always a step slow. And we were watching some college stuff. I'm like, he can't use his hands. And I started kind of breaking it all down for him. And he was like, man, did you play college football? And I was like, yeah, I played college football. And so we go on a little bit. And then he changed some cut-ups for the pros. And as he was watching some of the pro guys, he could see me watching. And he's like, oh, what do you think? And I was, you know, and I know the guys he's watching. And I was like, oh, so-and-so's over the hill in this. And he looks at me and he's like, did you play in the NFL? I was like, yeah. He's like, what's your name? I told him, and he was like, head explodes. He's like, dude, I'm this one of the scouts of the Rams. I know who you are. Like, I scouted you. What are you doing here? And I told him, I was like, you know, I got hurt in my 10th year and I retired and got hired by CrossFit to come teach, a seminar in terms of how to, you know, blend CrossFit with performance and sport and that deal. And we've been, you know, and I work as a contractor for Naval Special Warfare and I'm traveling back. So I had a pretty good conversation and he goes, man, I got an interesting question for you. He goes, we drafted this kid, like the number 3 or 4 pick overall in the draft as an offensive lineman. He's like, we put this kid through every ring or every test. He passed everything. We draft him, we put him out there and he can't play dead. He can't play the position. So they paid him, you know, tens of millions of dollars. He can't play left tackle. He can't play right tackle. We're going to have to play him at guard. Do you think that he could fool us into thinking that he was athletic? And this was like the conversation I'd had in my head. And I was like looking around, like, is this somebody punking me? Like, I said to him, I was like, 100%, let me explain to you how athleticism works. And we got into primal patterns and the ability to seamlessly and effortlessly combine primal movement patterns through space to accomplish a known or novel task, which is the definition of athleticism that I've developed for power athlete. And I actually showed him, I'm like, hey man, if you give me a 3-yard box, and these are all the movements within the 3-yard box, and I'm able to master those movements in such a way that they become seamless and effortless. And I can bend my knees and punch and timing and all that. And even though I can't play basketball and I can't do any of this other stuff, if I can master this three foot or 3 yard square box, and I can do things that you want, and I know what you're looking for, I can fool you into thinking that I'm athletic.
Mm.
Right. I mean, so that was really the second part of this known and novel tasks. Like, I can master known tasks, but really the element of athleticism comes with novel tasks where they're new, you know, obviously like the novel coronavirus, right? So what happened is when he was in college, he understood exactly what was asked of him, and the players weren't of a super high caliber. All of a sudden you put him in an NFL setting where now that 3 yard box gets stretched because guys are all of a sudden they're bigger, they're stronger, they're faster, and they're incredible athletes. And so what they did is they stressed him outside of what he was able to do, and they exposed that he was not athletic.
Hmm.
And as I explained it to the dude, his head like fucking popped off his body. And that conversation, I came home and I like just started to understand like not only what I was able to do, but how other people were able to do it and how I could replicate it. And based off of that definition, we started developing all the power athlete programs that you see based on this idea of fostering and developing athleticism. Right. And it involves being able to step, squat, lunge, push and pull in the primal patterns, and then being able to move in space. You got to be able to sprint, change direction, transverse plane. And what I really wanted to do with the power athlete system is when we started teaching it to people, I wanted them to understand almost like a blueprint that they could lay on top to understand other people's programs in terms of like, is this program developing athleticism? You know, if you look at a standard CrossFit program, it's mainly just what? Bilateral hip hinging and sagittal plane. Everything's a hinge and straight ahead. Now, based off my definition, right, you have to be able to step, squat, and lunge. You got to be able to stand on one leg. You know, sprinting is always, you know, is basically just a whole series of single leg movements. And you have to be able to go in different directions, spin 360. So if your training looks like nothing but just bilateral hip hinging in a sagittal plane, you're not training for athleticism. And that was when CrossFit approached me. There, you know, Greg Glassman's question of me was, do you think that the programming that we're doing is making people more athletic? And I said, no, it's not. And here's where your holes are. And then at that point, he said, great, you should go do CrossFit football. And that's kind of how we started that whole deal. And I think when I launched that training program, so you have to remember when CrossFit launched, it was like strength was just another aspect to work out of the day. One day you might have a 5x5, the next day you might run a 5K. All of a sudden I took periodized strength templates and started dropping them into metabolic conditioning cycles. And all of a sudden we started offering multiple workouts. And now I don't think you can walk into a CrossFit gym around the world that doesn't have a strength template. So that was kind of, as they told me, I virally infected CrossFit trying to get everybody to think that they were strong, which I'm totally cool with. I think everything's better when you're strong. It's a lot easier to move shit, you know, like your couch. Like, oh, you know, I'm like, I don't know if you guys have ever had to like ever somebody's like, oh, can you pick this up? You're like, yeah, sure, no problem. Pick it up, throw it in the car. I mean, I do that stuff all the time, and I'm like, oh, thank God I lift weights and I'm strong. I would never want to be weak.
Yeah, no, so, it definitely gives you confidence. That's for sure.
Yeah, so that's where Power Athlete started, and the mission's never changed. What we were able to really do is fine tune our offerings. And what I originally planned this thing to do was really a traveling seminar business. And that's what we did for 8 or 9 years. And then I realized that the people that were coming to the seminar weren't prepared for the seminar that in which we were giving. So everybody was constantly like, oh man, it's like drinking from a fire hose. And after hearing that for a number of years, I realized, I was like, shit, well, if people aren't retaining the information and they're not understanding it and they think it's great, but they can't tell it, then I need to have almost like a pre-course they take. So we developed the methodology as a foundational course so that if you came to an in-person seminar, you were pretty switched on already. You'd already read what we needed to read. You understood all the basics and the tenets of like strength conditioning in terms of, you know, Zadiskorsky and Berkoshansky, you know, Mel Siff and, you know, Dr. Fred Hatfield and all the people that I had used within my own training. And that was where the methodology came from. And then we started doing the methodology, and the people coming out of the methodology were dramatically better than the people that were coming to the seminars. So we just slowly just ended that piece and just took everything online, and it just became really cool. And then we just really started. And then there's always the idea of like, can you teach, but can you show? So not only were we teaching people how to train athletes, but then I had to show them how to do it. So that's where a lot of the programming stuff came from. And now we offer a series of programs, and you know, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people a day follow those programs worldwide. So it's been a pretty good deal for us.
Yeah, awesome. And I know the programs have kind of evolved a lot over time, but the core programs are still there. I can't remember the names of them, but
Yes. So really our flagship program will always be Field Strong.
Yeah.
Which is by far, to me, it was the first one we offered. And I really think it's the place that I get to test all the really jiggy shit. So we, I was big into like PAP, post-activation potentiation training for all of my NFL career. We'd always do something heavy, something dynamic. And then meeting up with Cal Dietz, we got into the French contrast and started understanding like foot position and angles. And what's been really neat is that the program has evolved over the course of the years to where, you know, we've had people follow that program for 5, 6, 7 years and have just smashed it. Then we also needed not only that program, but I needed something to make bigger athletes. So we created Jack Street, which was just based off of this kind of funny observation, man. Whenever we'd see dudes that were pretty big, we'd be like, man, that guy lives over on Jack Street. You know, it was just kind of a smart ass comment. Like if a dude was on a bunch of drugs or something, be like, things are healthy over there at Jack Street. So it just became this kind of joke about it. And I just named the program Jack Street. And it's just a straight up bodybuilding program. The idea that I can increase cross-sectional size of a muscle and make bigger, stronger athletes. So sometimes we have a lot of athletes that need to put on muscle and size.
Mm.
And just, I think bodybuilders have figured out how to create bigger muscles and bigger athletes. Now, if you compare that with some form of athleticism, you're all right. If not, you're just going to look like, big dude that can't move.
Mm.
I had a Fortune 500 CEO that hired me to be a contractor for his family and help him with like programming and like if he wanted to design a gym, and he just kept me on retainer and I designed a program for him called Grindstone. So he had a ton of travel and he needed really just a flexible program. So that was written for him, which ended up becoming like a perfect program for like expecting fathers or new fathers or people that had a ton of work to do. And so that program became really flexible and that's been a really great offering. And then when CrossFit Football ended, I needed something to do with all those people. So just trying to make a joke out of the whole idea of what I was seeing in the fitness community was this idea like, the guy with his shirt off or the girl who's wearing like, basically like a bikini to squat in and yet would put like a Bible quote. And I just like, or, there's like a four or five paragraph thing about loving yourself and yet like, the girl has more plastic surgery than you could ever imagine.
Of course.
A fake eyelashes and hair extension. So I just was like, just couldn't like the hypocrisy of the fitness world was so high that I thought I would just do a tongue in cheek humor. And that's when I created Johnny Wad, which was, obviously Wad workout of the day, but a double meaning, which is, Johnny Wad, who was John Holmes, who was a porn star. So it was just kind of a funny deal. And if you see all the branding and everything, it's all based on this like, heavy, hard, fast, everything's kind of has these sexual innuendos laced into it. Like everything's cartoon. And it just was kind of a funny outlet to have and a funny way for me to kind of take shots at what I thought was just so disingenuous.
Mm.
So all of this stuff is kind of layered in and it just meets the demands of different markets, man. Some people like, bang heavy weights, go heavy, hard and fast, done inside of 15 minutes, get in and out in 50 minutes. Other people like want to get super technical and develop athleticism. Other people just want to get big and jacked. Mm. Some people just need a day or two a week to get in the gym because the life's crushing them.
Mm.
So all these programs kind of evolved with time just based off of the archetypes that we were running into or clients we had or things that people were clamoring for. And it's just been really, really interesting because it's allowed me to test a ton of stuff and really see, how many people are able to make significant progress. And then the cool thing is that we have people that kind of cross-pollinate and go back and forth and kind of periodize themselves within different programs. So it's really allowed me to test some really neat stuff on a much bigger market. I mean, when we launched CrossFit Football, I think we had 17,000 hits the first day. And, we've offered over 1 million workouts. It's, wow. It's like some crazy amount of workouts that we've provided over the years and have all the data on them. So it's really allowed me to see what works and what doesn't work and, within a very, very large bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think there's been a misconception, particularly amongst the fitness population, that you have to do quite a lot of regular training, like get your strength up to these numbers or get your fitness up or your body fat up to this much before you go into athletic training, like before you start layering on anything that moves side to side or anything different like that?
I think that there's like a kind of an idea that, people have to have kind of like a base to build upon. And I think that base is always going to be strength. So, what I like to do is I like to build strength and speed and all that in concert with athleticism. I find like that people that use like kind of standard block periodization, like I'm just going to do nothing but strength training for the next 6 months, and then I'm going to do this and this. I always have subscribed to a more concurrent training program where I want to develop strength and speed and power and athleticism in concert. And I think when that happens, you can you might not make as significant gains, but it's kind of like, it's almost like an EQ on a stereo. If I just jam up one knob, everything goes up and it sounds like shit. What I'm forever trying to do is just constantly adjust all the knobs so that we can get to like what I think would be the perfect sound. And I think training fits a lot within that. But a lot of that stuff comes from assessing your own weaknesses. I mean, we've seen guys who's like, you know, major weakness is strength, and all of a sudden they get stronger and they run faster. We've had other guys who get stronger and they don't run nearly as fast, you know, because they all of a sudden become too, you know, too stiff in a lot of ways. So that's where a lot of like, you know, the idea of like, hey, I need to continue to do rotation, med ball work, a lot of Charlie Francis's kind of speed work and, you know, Derek Hansen. You know, a lot of GPP med ball stuff and just being able to use compensatory acceleration to move a barbell as fast as possible, which is something that I was fortunate when I was a young, you know, 14 years old, training in the old powerlifter gym when I started lifting weights. The old man made a funny point. He said, don't lift weights like old people have sex, slow and careful. When you lift weights, I want you to be as violent as possible. I want you to literally try to break the barbell on every single movement. I want you to take it from point A to point B with violence. And so I always look at a barbell, no matter what I'm doing, like with like a little bit of anger, like I'm going to try to fucking break this thing. And that idea of moving the barbell as fast as I can, something called compensatory acceleration that Fred Hatfield, one of his principles, and the old powerlifter that trained me, and he and Fred Hatfield were friends, and that's where it came from. And I think that notion or that principle of compensatory acceleration and that idea of being violent under the weights, that was the key. I mean, that allowed me to play 10 years in the NFL. And so when I would go punch people or we would hit, I was used to putting myself in those positions, like punching through people, hitting through people, moving as violently as possible because it's every rep I did was that way. Now, do I recommend that for everybody? No. Does it, you know, cause some injuries? Does it definitely beat you up? 100%. But it was what allowed me to do my job. So just key factors like that, man. I think, you know, the, like, how do I put this? Like, I really sometimes wonder when people walk into the gym if they really understand why they're there or what their end goal is. And if it's just to go in there and do something and like get a sweat and feel better about yourself, I'm 100% for that. But if you're training for something, like if I have a goal, you need a plan, you need somebody to point you in the right direction, fucking wind you up and let you go 100 miles an hour and sprint through a wall. And if that's the goal and you do that every day, you get pretty far.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, like people choosing what they're going to be doing in the gyms, obviously things with the lockdown changed dramatically. But before we kind of dive into that, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that. I want to know, what do you think about, obviously, sport has been stopped as well. Now, something like the NFL is never going to run out of money, so the NFL is safe. But then you look at some of the things down the track, you know, college, high school, all the people that are employed around those systems, and maybe less popular sports in America. I don't know, something like lacrosse, for example. What do you think, you know, if something like this kicks off again, obviously, in Australia, we're having sporting codes go bankrupt as well. And people having to bail them out, or maybe the sport itself just not existing anymore. Obviously, for the major sports, I don't see that happening in America, but what do you think needs to happen with the future of sport, and what are some of your thoughts around these issues?
Man, I don't know. You know, I mean, I like to think I know, but I don't know how you play like professional sports without fans. So I know the NBA is talking about going to Vegas and they're going to play in Vegas and they're going to televise all the games and people are going to be at home. I can't imagine going and playing an NFL game running out to no fans, not hearing the crowd, feeling that energy. I don't know how the NBA, I mean, they go play pickup games. Those guys are constantly in practice. But like, there's a difference when you step out there when there's 30,000 people, 100,000 people there and you have your game unis on and it's ready to rock. So I really wonder what that landscape looks like. Like, I don't know. I mean, it's a really interesting thing. I mean, I've been bombarded a lot lately with this idea of like, you know, hey, like, what about social distancing? What about like wearing the masks? And like, the smallest visible hole that you can see in a piece of fabric is like 0.1 millimeters. The coronavirus is 10,000 times smaller than that. So you can fit 10,000 coronaviruses through each 0.1 millimeters. So like a mask like made of cloth, right, obviously isn't going to stop that the way they think it is, but they're like, it's droplets here and there, and they really don't know if like masks and so, you know, work, but we do know that social distancing and avoiding these things is how we spread it. The other interesting thing is our immune system works off of basically a contact. So we get in contact with people, we trade our whatever bacteria, viruses, whatever it is, and then the immune system becomes stronger. So now that we flatten and quarantine people, our immune system is strong. So it's almost like when we're going, you know, like they keep talking about this idea of like quarantine second wave and it being much worse. It's because I think people's immune systems aren't as strong because they've been social distancing. I don't know how you social distance at a sporting event. I mean, they pack too many seats. What are they going to do? Sell one every five seats? If all of a sudden they have 100,000 people in the stands, and now all of a sudden they're going to ask 20,000 people to show up only? I don't know what any of these solutions are. And like, I don't know how you do it. And you think about lesser sports. Like, think about the high school kids that are like playing their last year of school trying to get a scholarship. And now all of a sudden, no, there's no more sport. There's no more opportunity for you. Fuck, man, I don't even know what the answer to that one is. And I think the problem is, so, I mean, we've worked pretty extensively with some really big companies, U.S. military, the government. And I think that there's a sense of a sense of relief knowing and thinking that there's some nefarious plot. And there's like this idea of like conspiracies and there's somebody at the top pulling these strings that has this architecture. Like, I think people are more comforted in thinking that than knowing the truth, that nobody knows what the fuck they're doing and are just out there pretending like they do. Hmm. Like, I don't think, you know, and whether it be, you know, Trump or the leaders, whatever, you see them get up there, they don't know. And, you know, their job is to give us comfort, right? Like, we're watching it because, you know, these are our elected leaders. These are the people we look up to that are supposed to be driving us in the right direction. And, you know, I mean, I know in Australia, sports are important, just like they are here in America. And you have these major sporting events and they're like, we don't know how to do these. What are we going to do? Are we going to ask everybody to stay at home and watch it on TV? What are we going to have these look like practices? Like, how do you do that? And then how do you protect the athletes? So then, I mean, how, like, if you're playing Aussie rules football, how do you social distance? What are they going to do? Everybody's going to have like a 6 foot rule, a 3 meter rule. Like, it doesn't make sense. Mm. Like, how does football, how do you tackle somebody? So now every player that steps on the field, does he have to get tested for coronavirus to be able to walk on the field? And then is everybody in the stands? Or who's, I mean, there's so many aspects to this thing. I don't even know like where to even begin. Mm. I mean, think about all the major companies, right? I was thinking about this. So a major company wants to reopen. So now they've gone in and they've retrofitted all these buildings with like touchless hand dryers, touchless sinks, touchless key cards, like all of the technology so that you don't have to touch anything. Like what does that cost? Like, how do you even do that? Now the companies can't open until they put all that stuff in place. Mm. It's, it almost is such a big problem that it's tough to even like even comprehend where to begin with this. Mm. And then the problem is, you have a whole bunch of people that like are so sure, like, this is the way, this is right. And you're like, what I know about Occam's razor is that usually the most obvious answer is the best one. Nobody knows what the fuck is going on. And I think that they don't have a solution for this stuff because they don't know how to protect people. Because, like, let's say you have a game, 100,000 people show up, and all of a sudden somebody's sick and it spreads through the crowd. And then all of a sudden now you have these huge swaths. But, I mean, maybe that's maybe Sweden's take of, you know, of herd immunity makes sense. But the problem is in the United States, you have probably like 45% obesity, and you have like 65% of people in this country, which is like, you know, 175, 200 million people are either obese or have some form of pre-existing condition that puts them at risk.
Is that how high the number is now?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like obesity is like 45%.
Holy.
And then when you factor in, yeah, it's like we had 280,000 deaths last year. I just looked this up because I got in an argument with somebody. 280,000 deaths in this country last year to obesity-related diseases. It's the number one killer. Like, you know, so it's pretty interesting. And then they found that people that are, you know, pre-existing conditions, obesity, all the other stuff, are at a much higher risk. Mm. So, which is crazy to me that they're not opening gyms. So all the gyms are closed. I'm like, why aren't we doing stimulus packages for gyms and for training and for trainers and for, you know, nutrition coaches and dietitians, so that people can go out and be like, hey, here's the deal. We can't protect you and your little, you know, your t-shirt wrapped around your face. But what you can do is you can get out there and be as strong as you can. You can raise your fitness to the point where if you do get sick, you can fight it off. I mean, or they got to come up with a vaccine. And what are they going to do? Keep us all sequestered and quarantined and we're all locked up until they get a vaccine in 2 years?
Yeah.
And do you think fitness and health, do you think it's going to come out stronger on the other side? I think sport, obviously, you know, it's been incredible. I think how everyone's reacted to it being shut down has reminded everyone how important it is for the country. There was like a politician here that suggested we play cricket through the winter. And it was probably like the most disgraceful thing a politician's ever said. And you know, people just really can't live without it. Do you think the actual on the ground, how much people train, how much people eat of the wrong type of foods will be affected, you know, 1 year after this, 2 years after this?
I hope so. The problem is it, like, you know, and I don't know how, I mean, I've traveled in Australia, but I haven't spent, you know, exorbitant amounts of time there. So I really can't comment on that. But I know here in the States, man, people, like, it's really strange. Like the fact that like fast food joints are all open, but the gyms aren't open. Like it just kind of blows my mind. I hope people realize that we're as vulnerable as we've never been this vulnerable, but the only protection against this is really to be strong. Like, I mean, I always go back to Mark Ripto's quote, which is so true, man. Stronger people are harder to kill. You know, like, you know, and if like you're going to the gym and you're slaving and killing it every day, there's a good chance that not only are you strong enough, but like, you know, your body reacts to exercise. I mean, it's really how we strengthen our immune system. So I don't think we put enough stock in it. And I think people are fucking generally lazy. I mean, it's just true. Like I had hoped for years that like the obesity epidemic had to do with like some form of like, well, it's hormonal. Or they can't lose weight because of this. And then as I dug into like endless amounts of studies, it's like, no, it's calorie restriction. People are overeating. Like this hormone thing, like, you know, your hormones, all the other shit, like, you know, you get into Jason Fung's insulin paradox and you go through all that and you're like, no. And it was hard for me to wrap my head around for a long time. I'm like, there just can't be that many people that overeat. And then when you look at the research and you're like, no. It's pretty true. Majority of this stuff is people overeat and they don't exercise. Right? They don't move enough and they consume too many calories.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, people aren't accurate because, as you guys know, man, like how many people actually have an idea of how much they consume on a daily basis and then actually match that up with what their energy expenditure is and then measure it with a weight, with a scale. Did I lose weight today? Obviously, I didn't move enough or ate too much. And I think it's not complicated. We had a dude on our podcast years ago that was like, I'll put this out to anybody. Anybody can get shredded. Anybody can lose weight if you understand how to measure your food and you can run a spreadsheet. And he said it, and I was like, man, that is so simple. And he's like, I've done it with, you know, thousands of clients over, you know, decades. But he's like, at the end of the day, people love, especially in this country, to point the finger at somebody else. It's not my fault. It's because of this. It's not. And you always hear him start with like, it's not my fault. And like the day that you realize, no, it is my fault. And you take personal responsibility.
Yeah. So,
I hope to God that the fitness industry comes out stronger on the other side. But like, I think what'll happen, and this is actually probably the best thing that'll come out of this. The commercial gyms are shutting down. I think Gold's Gym is going to go bankrupt. I know 24-hour fitness here in the States has declared bankruptcy. So, I mean, I know Gold's Gym has already shut down like 40 locations and they're talking about more, which sucks. But I think what it's going to do is it's going to bring people home to fitness. And it's going to be the rise of the micro gym, and people are just going to build out their garage gyms like we have. I'm sure you guys got weights in your garages, and that's where you guys train. Because it's the most convenient, and it's like, I want to have my own stuff, and I want to have it look nice, and I don't want to go and have somebody else's, you know, weight on something. I want to go and train. I want to have the stuff I want to have, and I want to go in and slay it. And I don't want to sit around. I mean, I'm sure you guys have been to a commercial gym. I used to go to, before we built Power Athlete, I'd go to this Gold's Gym, and like, it reminds me of how fucked up people are when you go to a commercial gym and you're like, what the fuck are these people doing? Like, I you'd almost like want to like unsolicitedly go offer them advice and be like, dude, you're going to die. Like, what are you doing? I like, I watched a dude who barely benched 225 load on 315 and drop it on his chest. And I ran over and deadlifted off him. And the guy was like, not even that thankful. He's like, I think I could have got it.
Get out of the way, bro.
Oh yeah. And it's just a really interesting thing, man. I mean, I love the idea of having, like, I love having my own gym. I always wanted to have my own gym. I always wanted to have my own weights. And it was funny because I had a commercial gym, like we had a CrossFit gym. And I realized pretty early, I'm like, man, I love the gym. I love having my own weights. I just don't like all these members fucking breaking my stuff. Because I always wanted to come in and train. Things were always misplaced, this. And I'm like, I'm not OCD, but like when I come in, I don't want to spend 30 minutes cleaning up or searching for everything. And I don't want to have to come in every day and fix stuff that like shouldn't get broken, but gets broken. So then I was like, you know what? I should have my own place. And I still own the gym and I went and rented a little warehouse, brought all my stuff over and had my own little private gym. And I was like, man, I will never be without my own private gym. And that's where we train. So I'm hoping that, that if anything, it's going to take fitness, back into the home where people are going to put weights in their garage. It's kind of like, I thought the best thing to ever happen to childbirth was that they started bringing childbirth in the home and taking them out of the hospitals. You know, and I think the same thing for weights, man. Like if you can have weights in your garage and have your own training, like you have to walk by that stuff every single day to remind you. It's like, here in the US, I think 80% of people that own gym memberships never go.
Yeah.
10% of those people go once a month. So it's only like somewhere between like 3-7% of people are regular gym owners or gym goers. So the problem is when the gyms close, those 80+% people just all cancel their memberships, right? Because now they have no excuse that they can't go.
Yeah.
And I think that's why they crumbled.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I remember my buddy who owned a commercial gym made the point. He's like, if everybody that we sold gyms memberships to showed up, we couldn't even handle it in the parking lot. We don't have enough parking spots for these people.
Yeah.
He's like, the fire code would shut us down at 10%. And I was like, that's a crazy model. He's like, yeah, the model is selling memberships that, you know, at a price that people won't get pissed and quit. And I was like, it's pretty smart.
Yeah, it's smart, but it's also, it's not good, right? It's smart, but it's building a business model that's not
business, but it's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, very unethical in a way. You're specifically choosing a price point where people don't show up and use your service.
Yeah. Or you give them strange values like at Planet Fitness where they would have pizza night.
Yes. Bagel.
Breakfast bagels. They were buying pizza so that people wouldn't quit their memberships because they're like, well, hey, I'm only paying $12. We don't go, but they give us free pizza once a week.
That's messed up.
It's a terrible, terrible and unethical. But maybe you need something like a market correction like this to fix that shit.
Yeah, yeah. I think this it's come. The time has come for that model. I mean, it's run since the 70s, really mid 80s. So now it's time for that model to die and for them to have to provide value for customers that come in like they did at the start. Those gyms in the beginning were like, all right, our best customers come in and train. How can we service them better? But now, I mean, we're really looking at people that are choosing to come to the gym. The culture is, the precedent was set, I might not show up. You know, we got gym memberships, so we don't show up. People laugh about that, you know. Oh, who's got a gym membership? Yeah. I do. When's the last time you went? Oh, it's been 6 months. How can we change the culture now that it's like, you know, if you get a gym membership, you're investing, you know, $100+ a week. You got a program, you got a coach, you know, you're actually here to lose weight. It's serious. And if you don't want to pay that price point, you got to work out at home, go for a run, do a walk, you know, do an online program. But gyms are reserved for people that are going to spend more money and they're actually going to get a result.
It'd be like joining a sports team. You know, you join a sports team, you commit to the team, and it's like, dude, join this team. I missed the whole season. Yeah. You know, we had the grand final on the weekend. I didn't even show up.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but that was really the model for the CrossFit gyms, right? Like, create a price point that people show up all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that's why, like, you know, at $180, I mean, we had 85%, like, we had 125 people and 100 people showed up almost every single day.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, and I remember sitting there being like, man, this model's unsustainable. Just because, like, with this high an occupancy rate and this type showing up, I mean, it's great for community and people get phenomenal results because of accountability. But man, it's a tough model in that respect. I honestly think that if the government subsidized it, like I forget what the CARES Act was, but it was some crazy, like, you know, $2 trillion here in the U.S. that they, you know, ran through, and which is hilarious because it's fiat currency. So that money doesn't really exist. Mm. All they do is just turn on the printing press and they create more money. So like, you know, like the, we're not on any gold standard, and it's what's called fiat currency. It's a paper money. So like, you know, they're like, oh, where does this money come from? I'm like, they just turned on the printing presses.
Yeah.
That's it. That's, they just printed more money. They just magically gave you more. Now they don't have to print it anymore. They just put a dollar in your bank account, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, so like we just magically turn on, give everybody this money. You know, and they're doing, you know, small business, and they're doing, you know, COVID, you know, all the other stuff. I really thought what they should have done is given it in the form of a credit card that could only be used in like for fitness, and be like, okay, hey, you know what? Our number one ally in this fight against coronavirus and COVID-19 is stronger, more fit, better immune system. So here's how we're going to spend your money. Everybody's got to be in shape. And like, you know, maybe it's a movement in that way. Now that's wishful thinking, because here in the United States, people like, and maybe they do it in Australia, they do it worldwide, they take pride in being unhealthy.
Yeah.
Like kind of like the man versus food eating challenges. Like people take pride in that shit. Like that guy, like that poor guy, Adam Rickman, almost died.
Mm.
Like they filmed one season of that, and the poor guy had to like quit season two because he was in such poor physical health that they like brought in other people to like, he's like coaching other people to do it. And they're like, why can't you do it? He's like, my doctor told me I was going to die. There's no way I can do this. I mean, he's going and eating like 30,000-40,000 calories once a week. I mean, the guy was like, you know, they exercise and train. And finally, he's like, I just can't do it. I'm going to die.
Mm.
But people like it's what they do, man. It's part of their deal. And, you know, and then we get into this whole thing where it's like, oh, you know, this is their choice and it's fat shaming and, you know, this. And I'm like, well, okay, it's their choice. But if they get sick with something like the COVID-19 or coronavirus, they go to the hospital and then they're taking up the dead and they're taking up this. So like now, and this is the issue we got. I mean, geez. So, about, man, 2010 or 2011, I taught a seminar in Denmark at Butcher's Lab, like the biggest CrossFit gym on the planet. So we flew over there, and I sat next to a guy who was Danish. That, like, I want to say he was Swedish working in Denmark, or he's Danish working in Sweden. But I know we were flying into Copenhagen, so take that for what it's worth. But he made an interesting point. He goes, he had just spent like a month in the United States for his company, and he was into a company that did like renewable energy. It was like windmills, which I think is hilarious because they're like hugely like the most inefficient form of energy, because the amount of energy it takes to put them up, and then once they stop working, they can't take them apart. He made a point, and he goes, you know, we were kind of talking about something. He goes, how in the world could you have standardized healthcare in the United States? And I was like, well, isn't healthcare human, right? And he's like, yeah. He's like, but how do you have standardized healthcare with a population and pool of people that don't care about their health? So if you're a healthy dude and you train and you do all the other stuff and you're in a healthcare pool with somebody else that doesn't care about their health, and all of a sudden they get sick and that's the drain. And his comment was, imagine there's 10 people in the pool, and one of the people in there, like, and you know, you guys have to be in this pool. This is your drinking water and the whole thing. He goes, what if somebody pisses in that pool? What happens? I'm like, well, I'm drinking a lot of pee. He's like, no. He's like, the problem is in the Nordic countries like Sweden and Denmark and these other countries, people look at fitness as part of their obligation. And if you're in socialized healthcare, then I get shunned if I'm unhealthy.
Mm.
You go to Sweden, people walk, they ride bikes, everybody's, you know, fit. And it's pretty funny. I brought this point up and somebody forwarded me thing that like now, like in, you know, Denmark, people are more obese, but it's pretty funny. I think their definition of obese is different than here in the United States.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I thought it was just a really interesting thing where he's like, you know, he also talked, he's like, you know, in those countries, we have a homogeneous culture. Everybody kind of looks the same. And he kind of went through this whole thing. He goes, you guys are so diverse with so many different communities, so many different value systems. I mean, when we moved to Texas, we got involved in physical education in the school systems with a company called Fuse that we work on. And they were trying to reboot training systems for high school and middle age or middle school kids because they effectively wiped it all out because somebody sued the state, went to the state Supreme Court, and they won, saying that physical education was culturally insensitive because the person who sued said that physical education was not valued the same way in their country. So when they came here, they sued for discrimination, and they wiped all physical education out of Texas, where it just became like, if you show up, you have a pulse, you pass. And the problem is that obesity and diabetes and all these other things skyrocketed, grades fell, and they realized that kids that exercise are better students, better able to do these things. And then they thought, holy shit, now what do we do? And that was, and that's kind of the, what we work on in one of our side hustles is this company Fuse, which is helping arm them with physical training programs and protocols so that they can implement them back into schools. So it's pretty amazing, man. I think we've gone so far to like acquiesce to everybody that we're effectively putting ourselves in a position like this. And I think like there's a lot of hard pills to swallow. And unfortunately, nobody wants to swallow a hard pill because if you do, you're a fucking asshole.
Well, you know, for sure it's possible because the way people look at people that, like here it's called on the dole, like you just take government money and you don't do any work. Everyone looks down so much upon them because they're like, oh, you just drain the society. Like we all work hard, pay taxes, and you're just a drain. I think it's in America, it's called welfare. And, you know, it's like already has a stigma against it. And you could see people having that same stigma against someone that is clearly just not taking care of themselves. You're like, hey, you're going to soon be a drain. And I'm the one paying the taxes on this.
Yeah. But then we hear in the States, people, you know, there's like, oh, you can't shame them. You can't do this. And, you know, instantly you're the oppressor. You're the person who's attacking. And then you become the bad guy. And, you know, and invariably, you know, with social media, very few people, especially if you're running a business, want to be known as the bad guy. You know, because then you're going to have people coming out. So I think it's difficult, man. But I mean, I really wish there was a social responsibility, but unfortunately, it sometimes takes some really drastic measures and a whole bunch of people dying. But like, I mean, it still doesn't change things. I mean, like the fact, I think what I saw a statistic yesterday is like 61,000 people have succumbed to the coronavirus in the last since it hit the States within the last like what was in February, which I think the first one. And that's, you know, over the common flu. So there's about 60 to 70,000 we lose a year in the common flu. But we're still at 280, 300,000 that we lose to, you know, obesity-related illness. So, and we haven't started closing down, you know, ice cream parlors and donut shops, you know. So it's, and the idea is people are like, oh, well, it's not something you can get infected with. Yeah, but it's still an epidemic. So how do we deal with that? You know, so It's a really interesting, the social experiment that I'm excited to see is what happens to the environment. Probably like one of the most, like I would say one of the more important things to me is like, you know, do we have, hold on. Did you guys hear that bong like popped in? I don't know what it is.
No.
On my side, like it was like boom, boom. I lost my train of thought.
Yeah, so you're talking about a change to the social environment and what's going to be different.
Oh, yeah. So, I know this is kind of crazy, but, one of the reasons or, one of the ways I look in time, when we figure out, who we're going to vote for our elected officials, I'm pretty big on, who's going to protect the environment. So, if, you know, Trump's talking about, hey, we're going to open up national parks to, strip mining and drilling, that's a huge problem for me. I love the national parks and, I'm If I got a chance to be president, I would be the defender of wildlife and nature. I think national parks and being able to preserve that stuff is so important. And fucking up the environment with oil spills and that type of stuff, nothing bothers me more than that type of stuff. So I think what's really pretty fascinating from this point of view is we've asked people to go home. People aren't driving cars. They're not traveling. They're not doing everything. And we've seen a greenhouse CO2 emissions decline by 70%, that the earth is regenerating itself. The amount of changes that they've done that have happened because of this, that they're able to quantify and being hey, this is the impact of what we've seen. And this is what's happened in such a short time in terms of how fast the earth can regenerate. That's exciting for me because I always had this kind of sick feeling, what's the world that my kids are going to inherit? And that part always kind of makes me nervous, and so seeing how fast that you put a shelter in home, people stop driving cars, they stop traveling, all of a sudden the earth can fix itself. I mean, I don't know if you saw the deal where there's no more holes in the ozone layer. So the last one was over somewhere in the Arctic and that's gone away. And, to me, that's super exciting. So if there's one silver lining out of this, I think it's that we can fix the environment if we were all willing to do it. It just sucks that it took a fucking deadly virus to push us over the top for this stuff.
Well, and part of it is that is how it came about is because, you know, you have such a sick population, you have overpopulation, and that's gives, an increased likelihood for these zoonotic viruses, the viruses that cross from animals into humans, you know, you have such a big population, so you create, you know, these feedlots and, you know, these wet markets or whatever there is. And, you know, there's obviously a debate where it all comes from, but, you know, just generally, obviously, the food supply and the food supply system to feed these people, it's going to break down somewhere. It's going to become, you know, more dangerous. And then as a way, nature's fighting back. You know, this is nature fighting back, going, we're going to wipe some of you out. You know, there's a lot of...
What do you guys think about those wet... Did you guys watch any of the videos of the wet markets?
Yeah, yeah. I'd seen them well before that, yeah.
Oh my God. I saw a video of this guy walking around with a camera, like one of like, I think it was the Wuhan wet market. And like, I was like, holy shit. Like there had to be 300 dogs in cages stacked up. And like, you know, you walk by and you're like, oh, people are going to eat all those dogs.
Mm.
And they're in there barking. And then you go through and it was like cooked rats on a skewer next to bats, next to this. Like I watched, you know, and then there was a video of this dude pulling out like it was like, I want to say like a guinea pig, slicing its head off, handing the body. I was like, and everybody's wearing a mask and not because they're trying to stop the spread. It's probably the smell is so unbelievable.
Mm.
But like that type of stuff, man, that's some next level stuff. Like I it was something that wasn't even on my radar. And I saw that video and I was like, oh my God, like, you know, but you think like, you know, look at the nation of China. What is it? 3 billion people. How do you feed 3 billion people?
Mm. Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, it's hard. It's easy to say when, you know, you can walk down to the shops and get a Quest bar and, you know, a glass of milk. But, you know, for these people, they're starving. And if the choice is between, you know, starving, you know, going without food or going with food, they're going to obviously choose food. And these are their only options. You know, they walk around, they've got 7 kids at home and they got $2. You know, this is all they can afford. They're going to make that choice every day of the week.
Well, dude, do you remember China had the whole deal where you can only have one child?
Yeah.
I think that thing got thrown out the window. But the other problem, too, is you run into with China is I think everybody in their Senate, like in their political system, is a billionaire. And not one of them started as a billionaire. So the problem is, I mean, like when you have like that large of a communist system, the haves become so separated from the have-nots because you don't know anybody. Like a socialist system works in a small group. Like if three of us live in a house together, you can have kind of a socialist deal because we also have accountability to each other. All of a sudden, when you talk about 3 billion people where everybody's faceless, what do you give a shit about your neighbor? So I think the problem isn't that China necessarily does that. It's just because, I mean, they have the resources, but fuck, it's just so many people.
Hmm.
Like, I mean, we're in a situation. I mean, think about this. We got 330 million in the United States. I mean, they have 3 billion people. How do you even deal with that?
Hmm.
And the way the Chinese do, I mean, I read an interesting one where a whole bunch of pigs got sick. So they went in and they slaughtered the farmers, slaughtered all the pigs, threw them in the river. And the pigs floated down about 20 or 30 miles and then created this like dead pig beaver dam and polluted all of the water downstream from it and killed an entire village. So the Chinese military came in, cleaned out all the pigs, burned everything, and then went up and executed all the farmers. So that's how they dealt with it. They just cleaned up the pigs, burned the village, and then killed everybody associated with it. It was like, then just left. I mean, I guess that's how you deal. Like, and people are like, oh, that's so barbaric. And I'm like, yeah, but like, that's how you deal with that large a population of people that don't have a vested interest in it.
Mm. Yeah.
It's a scary deal, man. I don't necessarily, like I've said, I don't know the answer to these world's problems. I think the problem though is that, and this is the scariest thing is, people that are really sharp kind of get into like private industry and, develop businesses and are entrepreneurs. And I think what we're seeing is that our elected leaders maybe aren't the sharpest people in the knife drawer. And we're all of a sudden putting situations and problems to them that they're not equipped to handle.
Hmm.
So I'm kind of a fan of like, reaching out to like some smarter people, not necessarily like a Bill Gates, because he kind of scares me a little bit with his whole like kind of new world order like vaccination stuff. But you know, like Elon Musk and some really sharp dudes. Like whenever you hear him talk, like those guys are thinkers. I really sometimes wonder if the way the structure of the United States is really gone in terms of like this one president of the United States, this one person in power, and you know this cabinet, this one elected official opposed from like a panel of people that prove themselves to not just be the person that's going to spend enough on a campaign and talk shit on the next person, but person that's actually proved themselves to be an effective leader. You know, like I was always amazed with Trump. Like why would Trump run for president? Like, that's the one that always fucking blew my mind. The guy's a billionaire. He's in his 70s. What does he need this hassle for? You know, is it ego? I mean, he seems like a crazy person to me. And I don't know how he's portrayed in
Oh, very, very fucking crazy. But, don't worry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But he makes a lot of like kind of preposterous claims. Like there's a lot of, Dunning-Kruger effect. I mean, like I'm the best in the world at this. I know more than everybody on it. I mean, it's classic Dunning-Kruger. Like it blows my mind. And, and then people are like, oh, he's a successful businessman. I'm like, well, how successful? If you gave me $1 billion, it's pretty easy to grow into another billion. Mm. But the guy stepped up and said, I want to do the worst job on the planet and I'm going to try to do it. And everybody's going to give me shit every day of the week for it. Like, it's unbelievable. Can you imagine having the entire like world media conglomerate outlet trying to fucking cut your head off every single day? Like, there's no way. Like, none of us would want to do that. And even like if you got up there and you're in that position, you'd be like, hey, slow the fuck down. Like, I'm just trying to appear to do the best job that I can. Like, I don't need you fucking assholes second guessing everything I can. And but unfortunately, that's not how the game is played. And I really wish that and not that I, doubt, like, I'm a huge fan of like the U.S. Constitution and the framers of the Constitution. Like, our founding fathers were so fucking sharp to be able to craft something that's lasted. But I really think what they, our founding fathers also believed or were against career politicians. They believed that leadership and like politics was the responsibility of the citizens to step up to do your job for a short period of time until the next guy comes, and then you go back to your private citizen life. There was no, like when George Washington, they wanted to elect him for another term, and he's like, my time is done. Somebody else needs to lead. Like, this isn't my job anymore. I had my chance. Let somebody else. And that was his first deal. Mm. So I think what's really fucked us, and I think it's messed up a lot of these world markets or world governments, is these career politicians, the people that get in there for 30 or 40 years, and they become so detached from running businesses and from dealing with normal people. I mean, they'd end up living in their ivory towers, and they just don't associate and they don't know the common people. They don't understand business. I mean, like, look at a lot of our politicians have never held jobs. Yeah, like Bernie Sanders has been in Congress for 40 years. He's never had a real job. Joe Biden, I mean, all these guys. I mean, if anything, Trump's the only guy that comes in having legitimately run a business. So I think that was, so like, that's where I kind of waver back and forth. He's not a career politician, but he sounds crazy. But then I also think maybe he's the only one honest enough to really say what he thinks. Maybe all these other politicians are just as batshit crazy, but they have people around them that are like, don't say that. Speechwriters, I just keep hoping that like a leader from our generation, and I like to say, like, I'm Gen X, somewhere within my generation. I know you guys are a little bit younger than me. Somebody who's really sharp steps up and is like, this thing is broken. And this is how I think we fix it. And you know what? Instead of one person, I think that there should be a team of really sharp fucking people like the Avengers. And I mean, like, the intellectual smart Avengers that come through, not dudes that throw hammers and shit, but like legitimately smart people that come through that have this kind of social responsibility and this idea of like, it's not just about me. It's about getting us all across the finish line, and are also strong enough to handle people some hard pills to swallow. Being like, if you're out of shape, you don't exercise, and you have all these pre-existing conditions, there's a good chance this virus is going to kill you. So what can you do? This is the plan ahead, right? And but then people aren't going to want to hear that. It's a terrible situation. It's a terrible problem. And every time I see whether Trump and the elected officials that like appear that.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure what happened.
Some weird has happened at my house. So we have like fiber, like we got the most badass internet to like, we had a wire, like fiber dug into our place, or like we should have like the sickest Wi-Fi and or internet connection. Every night around 6:13, 6:15, they shut the internet down and they reduce all the speeds. So like, as soon as I was talking to you guys, I saw it click off and I saw the internet go down, and I was like, every day about 6:15. So if my kids don't have their homework done, it doesn't work. So we like try to get everything done before like 6:15. So
that's weird.
It's either they turn it off or they slow the speeds or they do something. And then I just have to change up and go to a different Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, well, we're still here. Yeah, but anyway, I think we definitely went down the rabbit hole a bit.
I'm the worst at this. and like, I don't mean to bum you guys out on this stuff, but man, it's just in terms of like sport and fitness, I mean, to kind of bring it all back, like I don't know what the viable answer is, but I do know that nothing unites a country and a people more than sport. I mean, look at like, I mean, I always, we had Owen Franks on the podcast and, you know, from New Zealand and the All Blacks. And here's this little country of, you know, what, 3.5-4 million people that's, you know, been extremely dominant within their, you know, rugby sphere. And like it unites an entire country around it. I mean, I think for Australia and this, I mean, look at the Olympics. So, I mean, it's pretty amazing how sport is so universal and like people want to be, you know, feel like I saw something amazing. I was part of it. And I think the fact that there isn't sports to watch right now, like there's no basketball, baseball's not being playing. I think like within not just in America, but for you guys too, like something is missing. And we could go back to work. We can go, you know, so, you know, quarantine ends and everything. But if they don't get sport back on, I don't know if the world will feel like it's back.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about the things that people, especially in America, are wholly passionate about and spend a lot of their lives consuming and, you know, becoming obsessed with, and it allows them from the two sides of the political spectrum to come together and sit side by side and not argue and forget about that stuff. It's sport, you know. Sport is that one thing, you know. When you know, the dream team in America is playing for the gold medal, no one cares what your political beliefs are in the moment. That we just want America to win, you know, and that's like true nationalism, right? Where you're putting aside all your differences and supporting your country. And yeah, sport is the last frontier that we can do that, which is kind of unfortunate, but like you said, it's something that we definitely need. So John, going into the final four questions, I'm not sure if the boys sent them through to you, but first question we always start with is, obviously, you got a podcast. Who is left that you haven't interviewed that you feel like you would love to get on the show one day, and why?
Two people. There was a, if you guys listen to our podcast, I kind of went off on a tangent. I'm a fan of Joe Rogan, and I really like Joe Rogan's podcast. I think it's really interesting how he gives people free form room to really like get into some stuff, and like when I mean deep, like people get deep. He had Edward Snowden on the podcast. That was, you know, he usually does them in person. Snowden's obviously in Russia in some like weird, you know, like hidden kind of way. And he had him on about his book, and either Rogan, like either he was a little scared of it or he wasn't willing to really push the envelope the way that I thought he should have. He just kind of let Edward Snowden talk, and I actually ended up buying his book and reading it. And if it was me, and I know that, you know, Joe probably has sponsors and all those shit, I would have asked Edward Snowden the hard questions that I wanted to hear, which is basically, you know, if you guys know Edward Snowden, he was the whistleblower that blew the whistle on, like, you know, all like the crazy, you know, spying and basically the stuff that the government does that they shouldn't be doing. It's abandoned not only our due process, but our freedoms, you know, all the other stuff. And so his job was that he was in charge of all this NSA information. There's all these independent cells. So he was the guy that could pull all the information. So when the director of the NSA had to report to the president, he called Edward Snowden to pull together all the information. So he was the guy that knew what everything was doing. He all of a sudden has this moment of consciousness that this is going against the Constitution and really what America is about, that the U.S. government is spying on its people, abandoning due process, and pretty much violating all these, you know, liberties and things that we hold secure. And so he does the moral thing where he blows the whistle on it. Now, to get to that position, think about how many interviews, psychological tests, locks, all the other stuff. Can you imagine the testing and like the people that would have had to sign off on that guy, from not only like psychologists, psychiatrists, think about the steps and the hurdles that guy had to jump through to get to that position, right? You would almost have to be a sociopath.
Yeah.
Right. You would have to be able to have access to that much information and to be able to pull it together and still be able to do the job where you're like, holy shit. Not only are we doing this, but, you know, like we're doing stuff that, like, we're blaming other kind. Like, I mean, just the amount of information that he must have seen, like, the dirtiest of dirty laundry. And so he gets to that position, and all of a sudden, at that point, he has a moment of consciousness. They don't let people get to that position of moments of consciousness because they're fucking sociopaths. So what did he see, or what happened to him that made him think the only way that I'm going to survive this is by blowing the whistle and fucking getting out as fast as I can?
Yeah, what tipped him over the edge?
Yeah, like, what was the deal? And he talked about, like, this moral this, and I read the book, and I listened to him on Rogan, and Rogan was like, And I was like, this is fucking bullshit. If you're going to have this guy on, the most wanted man, like, writes this book, this whole thing, like, ask him the fucking hard question. What is it? Like, do they kill you? Like, does the guy that do your job, every guy dies of a heart attack in 2 years because they kill him and they bring in the next guy because they can't have anybody? And all of a sudden you were on day, you know, two left and you knew you were just shy of two and you had to get out. If that's the case, then I appreciate that. But, like, I didn't, while I understand and I read the book and I went through it and I listened, I was like, you know what? Like, I get it. But, like, there's something more to this. There's a reason that you did this, because you would never have got to that station on accident. There's no way that you could have bullshitted your way as a moral individual to have access to that, to get to that position and then see all that and then have some moral conflict. It just doesn't fucking happen. And if it does, then he was able to fool these people, fool the best people in the world in this. Hold on. I got a kid.
Got to make gains for the kids.
Yeah. So granola bar. So like that type of stuff, man. Like I would love to have Edward Snowden on the podcast to be able to ask him that question. I'd love to have Joe Rogan on the podcast just to be able to ask him that question. I'd love to interview Mike Tyson. I would love to sit there and chop it up with him. I mean, I've always been a boxing fan. I had dreams of being a professional boxer when I was young. I would love to have Tyson on just to, like, understand the depth of that dude. Like to be the most dominant heavyweight in the world at 20 years old, and then to, like, have the world on your oyster and to fuck it all up, look back at 53 years later and, like, realize that, like, not only do people consider you the best, but you could have unequivocally been the best for years. And, like, you know, the drugs and the partying and this and fame and that, and, you know, you can go back into Customato, didn't prepare him, and, you know, everything. And he was too young, and I think he, like, just somebody that has that much history and baggage, and just, like, you imagine being the fucking heavyweight champion of the world at 20 years old and the most dominant fighter to ever fight the game, and then to, like, flush it all the way, come back, goes to jail, you know, goes to Islam and this. I mean, just, like, that would be, I would love to have Tyson on.
Yeah.
I think Tyson would be great. I'd love to have Edward Snowden, and I'd love to have Joe Rogan. So those would be my three. I think the fourth one.
Have you seen Tyson's podcast? Have you watched it? Yeah.
He's good. It's great. I think he's what's really cool about him, and I really appreciate this, and I wonder if it's from smoking all this weed, is he's become very, like, reflective and very honest about it.
Yeah.
Which I think happens in everybody's life. I think you get to a point where, like, the facade doesn't matter. Honesty matters, because you have to look yourself in the mirror. I think in your 20s and your 30s, you can kind of bullshit yourself. You can bullshit other people, but you deep down, you're scared to fuck that somebody's going to really see through you. And then as you get older and you realize, like, man, I've been knocked down. I got back up. I got knocked down again. And you start becoming battle tested. And all of a sudden you realize, like, I don't care what people think, right? Like, this is who I am. And if they don't care, then I don't need them. And I think he's reached that point, and he's become very honest with who he was and the problems and the trials and the tribulations. And, no, I think it's awesome, dude. I love seeing, so as you guys, this should happen to everybody. You should get everything you want in the world and then have ego fucking knock your legs out from underneath you and then have to build it again, just to teach you the value and realize that ego's killed more people than cancer. My dad used to tell me all the time, like, you know, ego will kill more people than cancer. Ego will beat you down and teach you more lessons than anything. And, you know, and for him, Tyson's a great one. But yeah, that, man, that Snowden one, I listened to him, and he's a sharp dude, man. I mean, he's a very, very smart dude. And to have him, and I mean, like, to listen to that and think, like, fuck, if I had this opportunity, I would have hit this dude with every question I had. I would have got into details and been like, I read the book, and it was pretty obvious because the book hadn't come out yet. I don't think Rick Rogan had read the book, whether or not he ever did. But I would have been like, who are the players? Who are the people? Who set this up? Like, who decided to strike? I mean, did it all start with the Patriot Act and all of a sudden at 9/11 and this? Like, I would have just hit him with everything. I would have known. And Rogan was like, I'm not going to ask him too many questions. I'm just going to let him talk. And to me, that was a missed opportunity. But then again, who knows? And Rogan might have ended up with a heart attack.
You know? Yeah. That would be a fucking tragedy.
Some nefarious minivan shows up and he's fucking out. Like,
that would kick it off. Like,
I think the other guy would be, you know who else I'd really love to talk to and interview would be Putin.
Mm.
I think Putin would be another one. You know, Putin's considered like the richest man in the world, but they can't peg a dime to him. I read this whole thing about how this dude researched for like 10 years, all the Putin's, like, he owns like 50 mansions and this and everything. And yet, like, he shows zero money. He's by far, like, he's like the majority investor in like one of the largest energy companies in Russia. Like, they traced all this stuff that he's owns and connected, but yet he's not connected to anything. So he's by far like the richest person on the planet. Like, you know, like makes Jeff Bezos look like the fucking housemaid. And, shows no money and denies everything. Hmm. I think he's another one. I mean, that dude was head of the KGB and then is able to become president. I mean, fuck. Like, that dude, that's another sociopath.
Of course.
Like, yeah. Like, oh, yeah. And the crazy thing is you could probably ask him questions and the dude would be dead honest with you. Hmm. Be like, what about this? He'd be like, oh, yeah, no, I'm 100%. I'm the richest man in the world. Nobody can touch me. So he'd be another interesting one. Hmm. I think people that are like people that are really have like lived and done some amazing things, seen like this. I mean, can you imagine? He was head of the KGB in Russia. Like, and then all of a sudden the wall comes down, the whole thing, you know, Russia collapses, you know, and this, and, you know, it's all in this disarray and everything, and then rises to be president. I mean, fuck. Think about how many bodies that dude had to bury. Probably more than Stalin. So I think that would be super interesting for me. Mm. So even though we do a podcast on strength and conditioning, as you guys can tell, I my interests just don't lie in banging weights and making people strong. Like, I feel like for that stuff, man, like we got a pretty good code for that. Like, if people want to be bigger and faster and sprint through walls, I got that. But for me, like, I'm just really interested by like, so let me see how I put this. Like, I'm a legitimate fan of humanity. I know that sounds weird, but like, I want to see the best person and the smartest person on the world on the biggest stage in the biggest conflict in the biggest situation do their best and be victory. Like, I want to see, like, I go to a sporting event, I want to see the best player in the world play his best game and put his greatest performance and win the biggest title. Like, I want to see, you know, the person who gets to be president of the United States stand up there and lead a nation out of conflict and like have their great moment. I want to, you know, I want to see the Abraham Lincoln stand up and give the, you know, what is it, three score and 7 years ago, you know, get up and give the Gettysburg address. Like, I want to see that stuff. Like, I want to see, like, I legitimately believe that we should be given the greatest moments. And that's what I want to see. Like for you guys or whoever it is, I want you guys to be as successful as you ever could be. Make all the money, have all the accolades, do everything, and stand on the biggest stage and have people leave there and being like, I saw the greatest moment. I saw history. I'm so excited to be a part of it. And that's really what I want, whether I go to a sporting event or I see like a world leader talk, and I find like we're continually underwhelmed by people's performances. And, I hope when I go out and speak or anything I do that people leave there feeling like, man, that dude played 10 years in the NFL and went to Berkeley. He's a pretty sharp dude. Something he said in there really touched me more so than like, that guy was a fucking idiot. That was a waste of time. And that's kind of what I want, you know, like, to be polarizing. Like, and it kind of bugs me a little bit with Trump, because I don't think he's that eloquent a speaker. He seems to do better. Like, Obama was such a good speaker. I don't know if you guys like ever saw Obama, like reading off the teleprompter, the dramatic pauses, the way he controlled and this. Like, I had not seen a president read off a teleprompter. Now, Obama, when he also wasn't on the teleprompter, you could see like a little bit of the arrogance, a little bit of chip on the shoulder, which I appreciated too. But I just appreciated how not only how he presented himself, but how he spoke. And like Trump, like, you know, people are like, oh, he's a businessman. He's from New York. And I'm like, well, then, you know, fucking dress better. Like, your suits are ill fitting. Like, get a tailor. You're worth billions of dollars, man. Like, look fucking sharp. Be in shape. Show up. Like I don't know what he does with his hair, but like man, like, if I got all that money, I'm going to show up in a really nice Armani suit that's, like, perfectly cut, great hair, stand up there, kind of like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Like, when Arnie was the governor, man, every suit that dude showed up in, fucking impeccable, hair perfect, everything. Got up there, well-rehearsed, spoke, did great. Like, he's the type of person, when I see it, and I'm like, he dressed for the job. He showed up. He met my minimum requirement, which is look like a fucking leader. And I think with Trump, like, the ill-fitting suits and the weird hair and his ties are too long. And I know that shit shouldn't bother me, but it just fucking does.
Yeah.
It just does.
Yeah.
Like, it to me, it just looked like, and, you know, oh, you know, this. And, like, I think you can belittle people in ways that you don't really look like you're belittling them. I think, like, and Obama did great with that. But, like, you know, just kind of, like, be presidential. Be a world leader that other leaders look up to.
Hmm.
And, you know, and, like, I think, like, that's where I really struggle with that guy. And but yet, I'm a fan of America. I'm a fan of humanity. So I don't vote against him because I want us all to succeed. I want your leaders to be able to provide you guys the best opportunities so you guys succeed. I can never understand people that root against somebody in that respect. Like, they want to see him fail. And I'm like, why? If he fails, we fail. Like, we're all in this shit together, whether or not you think it or not. But the problem is that, you know, people just... I don't know. They lose sight of that shit.
Mm.
They realize that this is all symbiotic. It's all interrelated. Like, we're all connected in this way. And it's like, if you guys fail, we fail. And it's like, fuck, we want the best people on the biggest stage to do their best and perform the best. And if we can find that, I think we're going to be way farther ahead.
Mm. Yeah, that's, you know, good. That's good.
But also part of this thing, I think, is people started buying into ideology and they lost humanity, you know? Like, you know, like the ideology, and, you know, when you buy into ideology, it allows you to, you know, kill millions of people under the idea of ideology. When you think about, you know, humanity and, like, you know, being a fan of people and, you know, so, yeah, man, it's, these are strange times.
Right.
There's an old, what is it? It's an old Chinese proverb. What is it? May you live in interesting times.
Mm.
It's either Chinese or Japanese, but it's like, may you live in interesting times. And I always thought that it was a positive. Until somebody I asked one time explained, it's like, it's not a good thing. may you live in uninteresting times, which is peaceful times.
Right.
Interesting times have conflict. And I always thought, like, oh, yeah, you know, like, we want to live in interesting times. And it's like, you don't, you know. So, but we are, you know, this is the battle we've been thrust upon, and we have to make the best choices. You know, for me, I think it's, you know, making sure everybody around me is fit and healthy and people understand that, you know, hey, like, you know, you got to be able to be analytical enough to understand, like, I think what happens with our media so much we have in this fitness is really this idea of reactionary deal. Like, we get stirred up and there's this emotion gets hit and then people react to it. So a big thing I try to do is I try to take emotion out of everything and, like, listen to what they're saying and think, does this make sense? Is the information they're providing me make sense? What's the context for this? Like, why are they driving this information home? What are they trying to elicit out of me? And, you know, that just kind of came from, like, you know, obviously going to Berkeley, but, you know, in a way I'm kind of like a conscientious objector in a lot of ways where it's like, I'm going to go fight, we're going to the war, but I'm going to ask the questions on, like, why we're here, what's the mission, why are we doing this, and what is our version of victory? And that's something that we didn't see in this thing. Nobody has ever come forth, because remember, it was like, hey, we got to quarantine, we got to flatten the curve because we don't overload the hospitals. Okay, hospitals are empty, curves flattened, now what? Oh, now we got to all stay at home because we don't want people to die. Okay, but, like, what does victory look like? What, you know, what's the end game? How do we know that we're on the right path? How do we know that we're kicking ass and we're moving towards our goal to win, you know, to beat this? It's kind of like in sport. Everybody knows where the goalpost is. Everybody knows what's winning and losing. You know, if I score one more point than my opponent, I get to win. It doesn't matter what the points are. It doesn't matter if we win by, you know, it's 100-99 or 1-0, it's still a win. And I think what's a problem in the world market or in the world kind of stage is we've never defined what's victory this time. And we just have people just throwing shit out there. And it's like, you know, if we all have to stay home to flatten the curve so that their hospital beds are empty, okay, I'm game on that. If you tell me all got to stay ahead in social distance because we can't have people die, okay, that's fine. But then, you know, we have Planned Parenthood in this country that kills over a million abortions a year. So it's like that's like, and for me, that's like the weird hypocrisy of this thing. So we're staying at home to save people, but yet, you know, and I don't know how you guys feel about it, but like a woman's got the right to choose. I'm not a woman. I don't choose that stuff. They got to make their own decisions. They should have the right to choose, just like I should be able the right to do whatever I want. But yet they close gyms, but leave abortion clinics open. Like that doesn't make any sense to me, right? They keep fast food open, but they don't open gyms. That doesn't make any sense to me. So like when I hear this stuff and I'm like, I like to think I'm a fairly intelligent, analytical person where I'm like, how come this stuff doesn't make any sense? Am I the idiot? And then you get on, you know, you get online, you talk to people and it's like, maybe I am the dummy. Maybe I just don't understand this the same way. But this stuff all seems backwards.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, you know, there's so many opinions on it right now that we just got to see how it plays out and stay healthy and do what you can, right? Which is, you know, health and fitness is the one thing that we can control. So I think that makes a big difference. So just wrapping up here, John, you guys have Power Athlete Radio. I think that's probably one of the best resources that you guys provide. Long-time listeners here, so you guys always interview like amazing people and always ask the right questions.
I am blown away by the people we've had on our podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm like, fuck. Text would be like, oh, we booked so-and-so. And like, he'll tell me and I'll read their book and I'll be like, this person's coming on to our podcast. I've been really, really like always considered like very fortunate. I was like, you know, everyone, I'm like, that was amazing. You know? I think, you know, as you guys do, I think that there has to be a little bit of prep work, but you also have to have a little bit of the Larry King where you're curious about people. You ask some questions and you want to know, like, and then just give them enough leeway to really just entertain. That's something that I've learned much better in the, you know, 300 and some episodes, you know, where you realize it's not about me, it's about the person and putting them on the greatest, putting them on the pedestal so that they can provide the best information.
Yeah, absolutely. And for people that want the training as well, they can just head to powerathlete.com?
Power Athlete HQ.
Power Athlete HQ.
Power Athlete HQ. Yeah, the company's Power Athlete. If you search Power Athlete, we pop up. And if you search me, John Walburn, I'm easy to find.
Yeah, nice. And hopefully if we get out to America again for another podcast tour, whenever that may be, we were in Austin, so we missed you guys.
We came close.
Yeah, but we will next time.
Next time. You guys are more than welcome. I'd love to have you guys. But yeah, I really hope that we get back to this idea of traveling and going and visiting.
Yeah.
I had this whole trip planned. Like, we were planning to take my kids to Rome. And when I was in college,
forget about it.
I took this class that was like history of Rome and all the monuments. So I spent like an entire semester like memorizing the Roman Forum and this. And I'd always wanted to go, and I didn't get a chance. And then like my kids are a little bit older, and I was like, we're taking them. So like we were like planning this thing. We were going to go at the end of the summer, like in September. And then all of a sudden, this thing hit, and I'm like, oh, I guess we're not going to Rome. So yeah, we got to do something else. But no, man, I'd love to. Hopefully, we get to meet up. We'll take you guys out, and we'll have a good time, and just go from there. So
awesome!
Thank you for having me on, and more importantly, sorry to berate your listeners with all of this bullshit, man. And hopefully, you don't get too much hate mail. I'm like, that fucking American doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. Why you have that idiot on?
And well, last time we had you on, there was only good reviews. People loved your rant. So. I mean, last time you jumped on, you spoke about gun laws for about, I think, 30 minutes, but people loved it. So it's the passion. Well, they love the passion. Well, that's what it's about.
My wife is funny because she made a point once. She's like, have you ever thought about like running for politics? And I was like, no. And she's like, well, you shouldn't. You're way too honest. That's part of the problem. But I think there's going to be a change. Dan Crenshaw, who's a Navy SEAL, who's in Congress now, he's kind of run on this kind of honesty platform, and he just kind of shoots people straight, and people kind of dig it. I think people are, you know, and you guys will see within your elected leaders, I think people want to, like if there's a hard pill to swallow, I want to swallow it. I don't want you to sugarcoat it. Give it to me straight. And I think people appreciate that. But, you know, unfortunately, it hurts a lot of people's feelings. And we've gotten into this idea where, like, you know, as you guys have seen, if you read The Coddling of the American Mind, which I think is a great book, it talks about the idea that, you know, people have equated words with stress, and stress is damaging and it's hurtful. So therefore, words are weapons, and we have to, you know, reduce people's words, and now people can't speak. And it's become a really interesting phenomenon. And unfortunately, I think it's unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hopefully we get back to a point where like honesty and like hard work and being a good person and waking up in the morning and doing all that you need to do and, you know, being a productive member of society becomes fucking cool again.
Mm. I sincerely hope so. John, thank you so much for being on. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it too. Thank you.
Thanks, mate.
There you go, guys. An amazing episode with John Welborn. Obviously, some very deep rabbit holes, as we mentioned. And if you've heard of him before, as you probably would expect. So thank you, John, for being on. Thank you for the Power Athlete team for doing what you do. If you guys enjoyed this episode, take a screenshot of it. Tag us, tag Power Athlete. Share it on your social media. That is an amazing way that you can say thank you for the work that we do. And we thank you for those that post about it. And of course, anyone that leaves us a review, a five-star review on anywhere you can leave it. So on the iTunes app, on the iTunes store, anywhere that you can leave the review, we always appreciate it. And as well, guys, brought to you today, this episode was by Working Against Gravity Nutrition. If you go to workingagainstgravity.com, use the code MMP50, one word, you'll get $50 off that first month. And then if you go to True Protein for the best tasting supplements, trueprotein.com.au, use the code MindMuscle10, you'll get 10% off. All right, guys, thanks so much for tuning in and we'll speak to you next week. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the My Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the My Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to the mymuscleproject.com/The After Show. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.